Hello, welcome to Growing Wild. I am Charlotte Petz and this is Radio Reverb on 97.2 FM, online and on digital. On this month's show, we are talking about the sea. So we're going to be talking to Anne Thwaites, who's very enthusiastic about seaweed. We'll hear from Fran Corney of the Last Fisherman Standing project. And finally, from Paul Marchant, who is a part-time fisherman out in Worthing. But first of all, as ever, we're going to have a song. And my current obsession is Talking Heads and This Must Be the Place. That was This Must Be the Place by the Talking Heads. Okay, so this show is largely based around the sea. I have spent an extraordinary amount of time in the sea over the last couple of months because it's been absolutely boiling. And all you want to do, or certainly all I want to do, is just launch in headfirst daily, actually. And it's just got me thinking a bit more about our relationship to the sea and how maybe there's been some kind of disconnect over the years of our engagement with it and our use of it. So I caught up with Anne Thwaites. Now, she's a bit of a powerhouse and is engaged in so many social enterprise projects. And her most recent one that's coming up is based around seaweed. We all see the seaweed around and perhaps don't know that it is majoritively completely edible, depending on the levels of pollution in the sea that we're encountering at any one time. So she's been looking at how we can use this abundant resource and appreciate it more and understand the myriad properties that it has that can be beneficial to not only sea life but also to us. So I caught up with her on Worthing Beach and this is us having a chat and finding out a bit more about the wonder product of seaweed. We are on Worthing Beach and the tide is out and it's revealed a great deal of plant life, worm casts, stones, rogue stones that you stand on and weep slightly. But there is a lot of greenery here and this is edible.
So we have hundreds of different species of seaweed all along the British coastline, most of whom are edible. Now, edible is always subject to a bit of caution because seaweed is a natural filter feeder, so it cleans the water and it takes up the pollutants. So depending on the pollution levels of the water that the seaweed grows in, it's more or less edible. But there are a number of businesses now all along the British coastline, specifically actually in Cornwall and in Scotland, who have started hand harvesting seaweed and who are selling it for food purposes, so you can eat it. The one thing that you can, there's actually many more uses for seaweed, so not just for food, so you can use it as a fertilizer. So there's a seaweed production that's meant for plant fertilizer. You can use it much more commonly in cosmetics. So you will find more and more products at the moment that have seaweed as a cosmetic ingredient. And you can also use it as a plastic replacement.
A plastic replacement?
Yes.
How so?
So seaweed is a type, or there's a particular type of seaweed that is quite sturdy, and I've previously seen ways of turning this material into almost like a film, and so you can form it to turn it into plastic bottles, for example, or plastic replacement bottles, fill it with water, and then once you've drunk the water, the seaweed basically just shrinks back into itself when it decomposes.
Wow.
It's very experimental, but they definitely are working on using seaweed as all sorts of ways to see whether we can replace plastic with seaweed materials.
So it's a wonder product.
It is a wonder product. And the most amazing thing about it is that seaweed has been on this planet for much, much longer than any land plant. And one of the seaweed species is the second fastest growing plant on the planet. So if we were to cultivate seaweed, which is actually something that the UK government recommends, then we could grow seaweed in large quantities very quickly, and therefore sustainably work in the marine environment using a material that's completely harmless to the environment. In fact, it actually aids the marine environment.
Amazing.
And and that can potentially help us in all sorts of ways with our health, because seaweed is extremely nutritious if you use it as a food source, or, for example, helping us fight plastic pollution.
So how many different varieties? Well, just even on this beach, I can see a number of different species, varieties. How many do you think we have here? And are all of them potentially edible if the water pollution levels are okay?
Yeah, I would say pretty much all of them are edible, actually. So you can have, if you look at this, for example, this is sea lettuce. So you can generally tell sea lettuce from the very translucent green texture. And it literally looks a little bit like pieces of slightly...
Mouldy lettuce.
Mouldy lettuce.
Well, not mouldy, it's not brown, but it's sort of like,
it's
like
a little
decomposed.
Bit shrinking.
Well, if you chucked a lettuce in the sea and left it, it looks like this.
That's exactly what it would look like.
Yeah.
So sea lettuce is definitely a type of seaweed that you can eat. We have got here, so this is a bit of sea spaghetti, which is a very common seaweed that's edible. So generally you would receive sea spaghetti dried up from, for example, the Cornish Seaweed Company or the Pembrokeshire Beach Food Company, and you just rehydrate it at home and then you throw it in with your normal spaghetti and you've got a very nutritious dish there. Spaghetti and pesto with some sea spaghetti.
What about the stuff that is on the groins? The bigger, wider, broader leaf?
So that stuff is serrated wrack or bladder wrack, which again you can eat. There's something that looks a little bit similar, just with much smaller serrations on the outside, which is called pepper dulse, which is one of my favorite seaweeds to eat, and it literally tastes a little bit of garlicky pepper. So this one here,
that's the sort that I think most people would be quite familiar with. It's quite a palmate leaf.
So this is a very common type of seaweed. And you can tell, so this is serrated wrack, because as opposed to bladder wrack, which usually has two sort of these bubbles, so these bladder things in the leaf itself rather than at the end, serrated wrack literally just has the bladdery bits on the end. So this is the fruiting body that sends out the spores to grow more seaweed eventually.
So it's quite juicy. It feels like that would be quite a good meal.
It could potentially be a really good meal, yeah, yeah. I mean, literally, if you go to a place like Cornwall, and I would obviously only recommend harvesting with an expert and with somebody who knows what they're doing, but what you generally tend to do is you take a bit of seaweed, you only cut off the top third so that the plant is still living, so you never take out the whole plant, you just cut off the top third so that the rest can regrow, and you take that live seaweed home with you, wash it thoroughly, and then just throw it into the pan, or eat it raw or whatever you want to do, and you've got a really nutritious and really healthy meal there.
I would love to be able to eat the seaweed that I find on the coast near where I live, which is the southeast coast. But because of the unknown levels of pollution in the water, I wouldn't feel safe eating seaweed straight off the beach here. Whereas I know if you go sort of to Dorset down, that's quite safe. So how do we firstly find out what the level of pollution in the water is? And then secondly, is there anything that we can do to lobby somebody somewhere to... Because this just seems crazy that this is a huge food source here that could be being utilised, or in many different facets, like you mentioned. That feels like that's a really good incentive to clean up the waters.
I think there's several things that need to be done. I think one is, I think the general population, especially here in West Sussex where we are, has a historically quite negative relationship with seaweed. So they don't really see this as a benefit. Having seaweed on the beach does not count as a reason why you would want to come to the beach. In fact, it has kept in the past has kept a lot of people off the beach. But
why is that?
So Worthing in particular used to get tons and tons of seaweed washed up on the beach, especially after big storms. And so what happened was all of the seaweed washed up on the beach. It started rotting on the beach. There was also sewage, raw sewage going in at the time. So you can imagine rotting seaweed with raw sewage mixed in the summer months when it's really hot, basically created a stench that was unbelievable for inhabitants and visitors to Worthing alike. So what we are trying to do in Worthing with our seaweed project is to try and turn around that relationship that people have here with seaweed and basically say, you know, first of all, it's a very nutritious food source for us, but it's also extremely vital for the marine wildlife, which is why, again, you know, I was saying don't take the whole lot out if you do try and eat some seaweed, because we need to keep seaweed in the water for marine wildlife and actually also to produce oxygen for the whole planet. And on the other hand, so you've got like changing the relationship that people have with seaweed, and on the other hand, you know, talk to your water company and ask them about how they make sure that they don't release raw sewage into the sea, that they make sure that they clear up all of the stuff that does go into the sea before, you know, so that the big pollutants don't go into the seawater. And the other thing that we're at the moment doing is working with the Environment Agency to find out what actual pollutants are in the water and how safe it could potentially be to eat seaweed in Sussex.
Tell me more about the seaweed project that you have. What's it called?
It's called Neptune's Larder. And it's funded by the Rampion Wind Farm. It's a 1-year long project, and we are doing several things. So we're doing seaweed walks with people to identify different types of seaweed. We are going to start doing seaweed cooking at Northbrook College from September, and then we're also going to have a seaweed pop-up spa in March, April next year, where people can have a bath, a seaweed bath, but also have seaweed treatments and drink seaweed shakes and have seaweed meals. So we're going to basically immerse our guests in the world of seaweed.
Wow, all to raise awareness of what a wonderful product, natural product it is.
Absolutely.
Where are my shoes?
Oh. You took them off just there.
I did, didn't I?
Yeah. Did someone take your shoes? Wait a second.
Oh no, look, they're there.
Okay.
Who's taken my shoes? Seagulls.
Stole the reporter's shoes.
Unbelievable. It's all fine, they're just in front of my face. Genuinely did think someone had stolen my shoes, but they just sort of blended in with the beach. I hope that wasn't too much of a flippant end to something that actually feels really important and really exciting. And with this project that she's doing and highlighting and raising awareness of seaweed, and you can tell that she's really passionate about it. You may recognise her voice actually, because she was on the Pilgrimage show a couple of shows back talking about her experience doing that. So yes, like I say, engaged in many things. So I'll put some links up to that project that's coming up on the show page, on the Growing Wild show page on RadioReverb.com, and you can check out more there. If you are interested in cooking with seaweed, then there's someone called Pranny Rattigan, who is Irish and has released a wonderful cookbook and lots of information about how to cook with it and various other things to do with seaweed. So check that out if you're interested. Okay, so let's have a song. And I know Anne likes a good old sea shanty, so for her, I've got to play it. I mean, come on, it's I used up most of my sea-based songs in the plastic pollution episode, so yeah, I've gone for a sea shanty, and it's of course it is. It's the Drunken Sailor.
With a rusty razor, shave his belly with a rusty razor, shave his belly with a rusty razor early in the morning. Way hey, and up she rises, way hey, and up she rises, way hey, and up she rises early in the morning.
We'll put him in a longboat till he's sober, put him in a longboat till he's sober, put him in a longboat till he's sober early in the morning.
Way hey, and up she rises, way hey, and up she rises, way hey.
Oh, how good is that? That was by the Irish Rovers. How much fun would it be just to go out dancing to that? Let's do that. Should we all just go and do that? Let's go and find somewhere that sings solely sea shanties and dance to that with a tankard and cider. Okay, next up we've got Fran Corney. Now there's this brilliant project that has been running for the last couple of years called The Last Fisherman Standing. I'll let Fran tell you a bit more about it. She's the project officer and it's been funded by the Heritage Lottery Fund, and she's going to tell us more about the different projects that they ran within that title. And it was a project born from realising just how few fishermen now were operating out of Worthing. And it's gone from 100 boats down to one part-time fisherman called John Booker and a couple of others, and one of which we'll hear from later in the show, called Paul. And I think it was just to sort of highlight and capture some stories of these fishermen in the hope that those stories wouldn't die just because this smaller fishing industry, you know, has effectively died off, and it's all about the big trawler boats now. So this is Fran telling us more about the project in her lounge with a small baby that was in the background. So you may hear him every now and again, but that's quite sweet, really. Okay, so here's Fran.
So it's a Heritage Lottery funded project, and basically the aim was to preserve and celebrate the fishing industry in Worthing. Get people understanding sort of the importance of what Worthing was like as a fishing industry, and also celebrate the fishermen that we unfortunately don't have any full-time fishermen left on the beach, but celebrate their lives and also understand sort of, you know, the challenges that they faced.
Why did you think that was important? Was it to try and for people to sort of re-establish the link with the sea a bit more, or?
Yeah, sort of the connection with the sea. I think it's quite a lot of it's been lost, really, unfortunately. And also sort of thinking about sustainable fish, and getting people sort of clued up a little bit more about what's in season, and sort of trying to get people to buy directly from the fishermen. As well as, obviously, you know, these fishermen are not young anymore. They're sort of in, you know, a lot of them we've been interviewing are sort of in their 70s, although sort of the part-time fisherman, John Booker's in his 70s. And obviously his memories and things will get lost if they weren't captured. So we did quite a few interviews with some of the fishermen and sort of found out, you know, what it was like to be out at sea. you know, what it, you know, in the fog, in the snow, you know, what they liked, what they didn't like, you know, how they would catch fish, the nets and things that they used, what the boats were like and things like that. So,
what came up as the biggest difference between then and now?
I think the amount of fish that are in the sea. And it's just, the level is just reduced and there's hardly anything left, unfortunately. Mm. I mean, they'd talk about, newspaper articles and things that we'd found, you know, there'd be thousands of fish that would come up on the beach that they'd have caught, like mackerel and herring and things like that. And now it's sort of really drastically reduced. And obviously with quotas and things like that from the Marine Management Organisation, that the small boats, sustainable boats, can't catch that much anymore as well.
What did you learn from doing this project? What was the most interesting things that you've learned from having... Because it's been going on for 2 years.
Yeah. I think for me, it's probably been... The fishermen have been the main... They've just been the highlight of the project. Just because I think sort of the fishing industry is seen as quite a low level occupation, I suppose, or it has historically, and that's what we found when we researched, that obviously it hadn't been highlighted, and we found quite a lot of, you know, great information. And I think sort of speaking to them and seeing, you know, doing a film on them and things, they suddenly became really proud about what they did and what they do, or, you know, what they did in the past, and I think that's been really lovely to sort of capture that they were sort of the stars of the show.
Are there any young fishermen of their ilk, you know, these older guys who go out kind of part-time and they catch what they can and sell it on the beach, and are there any younger people coming through trying to do the same thing?
No, not really.
Not at all, no.
Talking to the fishermen, I mean, there's no apprenticeships, nothing sort of that gets young people into fishing. I think it's a hard life. That's what we found out from the fishermen as well. It really is a hard life. You know, it's not easy. They don't make lots of money. Obviously, it's really dangerous. Most of the fishermen go out on their own. You don't know what you're going to come across out in sea. The weather could just, you know, change from one minute to the next and suddenly you're in a storm or something. So I think that's... And obviously because of the issue with not being able to fish on the quotas that they get as well for their small boats. Obviously, they can't really make much of a living off of the numbers that they're allowed to catch as well.
Mm. Do you think anything within that will change, or do you think it's just going to get harder and harder for the smaller boats to continue? From the sort of information that you've gathered with this project.
I think it is going to might get harder and harder. Yeah, unfortunately.
I feel like those boats are prime hipster
territory.
So you can see this sort of blossoming little cottage industry.
Yeah, that's true. And I think, I mean, although the heritage obviously was the main focus of the project, but I think also sort of the engagement that we've had with regards to volunteers and also local people just getting involved with our fish cookery was really popular, our monthly fish cookery courses. People loved learning about seasonal fish and what to do with it and different ideas of recipes, and also sitting and eating together as well was a massive sort of... loved it, especially people that would sit and have dinner on their own most evenings.
So the loss of these smaller industries feels like it's just a loss of community.
And that
if you are on your own, you can just go down to the beach and have that experience.
Exactly. And obviously the fishermen have got loads of knowledge and they're happy to share with you how to fillet a fish, how to gut a fish, what to do with it and things like that, which I think people really enjoyed. And I know that since the project, John Booker's stall has become increasingly busy as well. So people have sort of caught onto the idea that he's, one of the last part-time fishermen that's selling fish. And proper, he's going out to see him properly catching fish. And people know it's fresh and are going down and getting what he's caught and things, which is good.
What are the bits that you've done under the heading of the Last Fisherman Standing? Have you made some videos with them?
Yeah, so we've done videos of the fishermen, obviously just to celebrate what they do. We've done interviews as well with the fishermen, which are going to be held at the record office in Chichester and archived. Volunteers have basically done all the research, which has then obviously... helped with all our sort of heritage interpretation, so we've created a fisheries booklet of Worthing and sort of all the facts and figures and census and things like that we found. We've done a boat building workshop, which we did last year for 4 days, basically restored and steamed the ribs into an old clinker built fishing boat.
Oh wow.
Which again, you don't usually get the opportunity to do that very often. So the people, the participants that took part absolutely loved that. As we've done the cookery classes, so for 12 months we did monthly cookery classes. We did a school outreach project. So we had schools in the local area come down and learn about fish stock, fish quota, seasonality of fish, all sorts of things.
Lots of different elements. Engagement, really.
Yeah.
Just various different routes to try and engage people. And how have you found, have you seen any results from that?
So one of the longest generations of fishing families, the Bashfords, they've done up their locker since, which is right by the pier, and they're looking to potentially sell fish from that. So it'd be another potential fisherman, fisherwoman, that will be selling fish on a regular basis. And I think there's another new fisherman who is looking again to go out as well from the project and seeing the popularity of, people wanting fresh fish. Obviously, all the engagement and people, we've had thousands of people sort of interested in the project and sort of going along and seeing all our research and we had a peer exhibition for a year.
Do you see that if there's any longevity with the project, if you could, would you like to be able to continue it, or do you feel like you've done what you wanted to do with it?
Originated from a scheme called Catchbox. I don't know if you've heard.
Yeah, I used to get one.
Okay, nice.
Yeah.
Since the last sort of full-time fisherman, which was in 2015, that slowly obviously stopped due to the fact that we couldn't get regular fish. But from the project, we've sort of since surveyed people that have been part of the project when we've been on stalls and part of the food and drink festival in Worthing, And we've noticed, obviously, that people are really keen for that to maybe start up again. And for people to get weekly catches of fish directly from the fishermen.
Is that possible then with the...
So we're thinking potentially, because obviously there's quite a lot of fishermen that still fish from Shoreham, because it's just so much easier to fish from a harbour than to fish from, to do beach launch fishing from where, like in Worthing. We're sort of looking into how we can set that back up really, and see if that is a possibility. But that definitely would be, I think a massive plus to the project. Again, like I said, with the fact that the John, again, who's sort of seen a massive increase in his, in the fish sales and things like that.
Is there anything ideally that you'd like to have come from it? Would you like to see what more fishermen, or what would you like to see happen?
Definitely. I think it would have been lovely to have suddenly had, loads of people suddenly interested in fishing and be like, yeah, we want to go and fish, or young people especially, and maybe like an apprenticeship scheme sort of set up or something. That would have been a massive highlight to the project.
So what do you think was the most important thing that came from being a part of the project? What did it bring for you to be engaged in something like that?
I think for me it was the variety of people I've met throughout the project. So whether it's from the fishermen to, obviously, the council had a big play in it as well. We worked quite closely with the council, of the school children just getting so excited about seeing a fisherman and putting all the outfits on and things like that. And the volunteers as well, just how engaged they were and how amazing they were in sort of, wanting to do all this research and spending hours and hours just in the library. The community aspect of it, I think, for me has been the strongest thing, and absolutely loved talking to a variety of people, and the fishermen, of course.
That was Fran Corney there of the Last Fisherman Standing project. It's a shame that it's come to the end of its life, actually, because it's just been going for 2 years. And it's just being wrapped up there, just writing all of the final reports on it. But it was such a brilliant thing to do, just to highlight all of those people's stories, to capture them, to reignite some engagement with the sea and with fishermen, and to, really respect the fact that those smaller scale businesses are disappearing, and it's just being scaled up and scaled up. And the amount of nets you need to carry on a boat now in order to make a living out of fishing is too big for those small boats that you see. If you want to find out more about the project that ran The Last Fisherman Standing, then I will put links to that, as ever, on the show page on Growing Wild on radioreverb.com. Within that interview, there was a reference made to something called Catchbox, which I didn't explain well enough within that interview, because I just said, I used to get one. So that was effectively a scheme. It's a lot like a veg box. You get your weekly or fortnightly box, and you never know what's going to be in it. It just comes from whatever's in the sea from the catch that day, and it was a brilliant scheme, and I learned about so many different types of fish that I wouldn't normally have bought, because I just didn't know were actually in our seas and were accessible. So things like cuttlefish, they look like weird little alien beings, and certainly not something I ever knew how to fillet and gut and all of those things. So it was really educational alongside being incredibly tasty. So it would be lovely if that scheme could come back and run again. It was just the fact they weren't getting regular enough fish, because there is just such a decline in fish numbers now comparatively to what there was, sort of 100 years ago. The numbers are just so down. Okay, we're going to have another song. And I was going to play something else, but after playing that sea shanty, I enjoyed it so much, I'm going to play another one. Here are the Cornwall's Own Pirateers, and You Can't Hold a Good Man Down. That was You Can't Hold a Good Man Down by the Cornwall's Own Pirateers. I did get slightly sucked in by the YouTube prefix of best sea shanty ever written. I'm not sure I agree with that, but it was lovely anyway. Okay, you are listening to Growing Wild. I am Charlotte Petz, and this is Radio Reverb on 97.2 FM, online and on digital. Okay, so finally we're going to hear from an actual fisherman. He's called Paul Marchant, and he just does it part-time now, really just for fun, because of, as we've talked about, how hard it is to make a decent living out of going fishing out of these smaller boats now. I'm up with him by his lovely boat. You know those beautiful boats you get on, they're called clinker boats, they're the wooden boats that you get kind of hauled up onto the beaches, and they really are, like I said to Fran, they're prime hipster territory. I can fully imagine those going out soon with bearded woolen folk. That's what a hipster is, right? So yes, I caught up with Paul and we just had a chat about some of his stories from being a fisherman and how he feels the current situation does affect these smaller guys and his opinion about what could change, really, just to help them out a little bit. So here's Paul explaining to me what you do when you take your boat out when you want to go out and catch a few fish.
So in the morning, you push your boat off the beach and you follow your marks from the land out to where your flags are. And it's a lovely feeling, because you never know what's in the nets. So you grab the flag, it comes in the boat, and you pull the line into the anchor comes in the boat, then the nets start coming in. And my brother is in the back of the boat, and we pull the nets over a big sturdy piece of wood. Any crabs that are in there get smashed out with a mallet, and it goes everywhere. It's always very funny when you get your brother in the face, and there's always a giggle. And then any fish that comes in, the guy at the back takes the fish out, chucks it into a box. But I love being up front hauling, because you're looking down and you never know what's going to come up. And every now and then a big cod will come up, or a lobster sometimes.
Oh, wow.
It's great, you never know. More than often, nothing comes up. And you come back and you're really depressed, and you think, why did I bother doing that?
How long do the nets go out for? So do you go out, put the nets, and then...
The nets will stay out there all night.
And then come back in,
yep,
sure.
We'll go out, put the nets out, they'll stay out there all night, and then in the morning we'll go out and pull them in, or haul them in, as they say. So the nets are out there, anchored to the seabed all night.
And you line it up, you have to get your marker so you know where they are.
Yes, I mean, you can use a GPS thing, but for years, the gasworks in Worthing was a good landmark, the pierhead. You line them up and it takes you out to where your nets are.
How early do you have to go out and check them?
Well, you're governed by the tide, really.
Okay.
We can push these boats down to the edge of the stones. Any further than that, it gets really hard work. So you're governed by the tide. If the tide is, say, 6 o'clock in the morning, you can get off the beach till up to 9 o'clock. But we usually like to go early in the morning, so you've got time to work your nets, then come back in the shore and then sell it off the beach. These little boats here, we're all classed in the 10 metre and under class. But they're about 4 or 5 metres, these boats. But there's so many rules and regulations and quotas, and you wouldn't believe it. Even for these tiny little boats that can do... Every boat on Worthing Beach was to work as hard as it could the whole year round, we wouldn't put a scratch in it. It's all sustainable fishing here. Trawlers, if they catch fish that's undersized, they can't land it. It's dead. They've got to dump it. Why they don't take these little boats out of it and just say, do what you want? And recently they've banned... These nets under this canvas here a drift net. They float on top of the surface. But they've recently banned us using these to catch bass. And there's nets all along the beach now that can't be used, which is a kind of a good thing in a way, because it will give the bass a chance to restock.
Okay.
But what'll happen when it does restock? They'll go out there with great big nets and catch the old bloody lot, you know.
Right.
Why they don't leave these little boats alone? It's beyond us.
How does that affect your livelihood, having the same regulations as these bigger boats?
I mean, because we're only part-time, my brother and I, we probably spend more money on outboards and nets and oar skins than we actually make. And we just do it because we love doing it. And it's great fun selling fish off here to people. We're having a yak, and there's the local restaurant, The Fish Factory, smashing guy who owns that. And any fish we don't sell down here, he just buys off us. He's had a lot. And it's good for him because he puts up fresh-caught fish.
Yep.
It's great for us when we walk past everyone waves, and it's lovely.
So it's almost more of a community thing, as opposed to
Make
a living from it.
Yes, yeah. You couldn't make a living off the beach now.
Did you used to?
When we were kids, you could make a living. There was a lot of boats up by the pier, and you could make a living. But The guys that used to be on Worthing Beach are now in Shoreham Harbour with great big boats, and they can fish loads and loads and loads of nets and still make a living. Mm. But with these little boats, you couldn't carry enough nets to make a living.
Mm. What is available out there to catch at the moment, and what's the situation with bass that you mentioned?
Well, with bass at the moment, because we're a licensed boat, we can catch as much bass as we want. But we were told about, must be about 2 years ago, we had a letter from the fisheries people saying we could no longer catch any bass because there was no record of us selling any bass to the markets in Shoreham. But we don't do that, we sell it off the beach. So we had to prove we had caught fish. The onus was on us to prove that we had caught bass. And what happened was, there's in Hastings, there's a lovely community of fishermen down there. And there's a guy down there, Paul Joy, who is very, very knowledgeable. And we phoned him, you know, said, we're having a problem here. And he said that they haven't thought about this. He said, there's an old bylaw that says you can sell lots of fish, I think it was under 25 kilograms, without keeping records. So he had asked the fisheries officer to clarify this for him. And he'd sent a great big long email saying this was the case. So what we did, we sent a copy of that email back to them, saying that this is from the horse's mouth, your end, saying that we can do this, so we didn't have to prove we caught bass. So we were allowed to catch bass.
Okay.
But it was great, just a little blokes like us fight the system, you know. So you can catch bass, you can catch mackerel, mullet. There's not a lot of mullet these days.
How have you seen it change? How many years have you been doing this for?
Well, when we were kids, about, we started when we were about 15, 16, I suppose. So on and off for 30 years, I suppose.
And what sort of things were you bringing in then?
Oh, in those days, you know, there was loads more fish. Loads more fish. I mean, the mackerel has hardly shown for the last 3 years. The cod hasn't shown for the last couple of years. A lot of people blame the wind farm with the constant banging out there, but you can't really prove that, you know.
Mm.
So things have changed a lot over the years.
Is it mainly in volume as opposed to in species?
Yeah, mainly in volume, yeah.
Yeah.
And as I say, there's so many rules and regulations now. I've seen John along there, the fisherman. I've seen him in tears, where he's been out with his nets, and you can't tell your nets not to catch a certain kind of species. Now, they catch what they catch. And John's had to throw dead cod back over the side because he's not allowed to land it. And it's crazy. Now, why? Now, why can't they bring it in, give it to all people's homes? But it's everything that goes with it, you know, nets and safety equipment we have to carry, which in the old days, no one did. But, I mean, a lot of people died in those days. No?
So that bit's all right.
We had to go to when we got a licence, even though we've done fishing on and off all our lives, we had to go and do a health and safety, a fire... Was it a fire, first aid, a radio? There's certain courses that you have to do in order to be allowed to use your fishing licence. Even though you've been doing it all your life, you know. We've got radios, a first aid kit with an angina spray in it, a life ring, a fire bucket. I mean, you're almost a danger to yourself, really. You've got so much safety gear on the boat.
Can't fit any more people in there, either.
That's why we have that big rigging in the back. We hang it on there.
So, ideally, how would you like to see this run? You know, just for you going out in this boat. How big is this boat?
This boat is about 16 foot long. But there's a proposal or a rumour going around now that they're thinking of banning all nets within a 3 mile distance from the shore. Well, that'll pretty much be an end to this sort of fishing, because what'll happen, all the big boats in Shoreham will just blitz the area 3 miles off, and there'll be no room for these little boats to go off, you know. What they should do is leave these little boats alone. Just take them out of all the quota system, because they'll self-regulate. And as I say, if we went full bore, we wouldn't even scratch the surface. Leave them alone.
Do you think that's an answer sort of to the wider problem generally with overfishing and whatnot? Do you think if we brought it back down to a smaller scale and just had these smaller boats without the huge great big things going out and trawling everything?
Without a doubt.
And making it back to being a localised business? And
yes, yeah. But, I mean, once money gets involved, then rules go out the window, don't they? I think the days of, like, family fishing are long gone, aren't they? I think all the boats are owned by people with money and they get people to run them, don't they?
How did you get into it?
We got into it because when we were kids, we lived out of town in Durrington, middle of nowhere. And my dad's brother started fishing by Worthing Pier. And on the weekend, my dad would bring us down and we'd jump in the boat and play with the crabs and see the fish. It was like paradise for kids, wasn't it? And then it was really lovely, that was. And then we moved down to Worthing when we were about 13, and my dad was in a pub and heard of someone selling a boat up there and bought it for us. And then that was it. We were just on the beach day in, day out, you know, all the summer holidays. Just fell in. I mean, it's lovely. Look at it, you know. It's a great place to come. There's a locker along here, by the guy. He's the right character. And once one person turns up, you open your lid and put the kettle on. Come down, you talk a lot of rubbish, and you go home and you feel a bit better.
It feels like the loss of these little boats going out and everything, it's a loss of a community. It's much more than just an income.
There used to be a pub on the corner up here, the Half Brick, and at weekends there was so many boats through here, and especially when the herring were in, you're going very close for the herring, and then the men would bring their boats up and go in the pub. And they'd sell the herring in the pub. You know, I can remember my old man coming back with a bag full of herring. Pretty lovely, isn't it?
What is your favourite fish that comes out that you like to eat?
Bass.
And the best way of eating it?
I like the best way of eating it, baked in the oven with a bit of white wine and a big knob of butter in its belly. Keep it simple.
Yeah, is that fresh?
Why taint the flavour?
It does really make you want to go out there and have a go and go out on one of those boats and just hang out in the sea and see the world from that perspective, and everyone buzzing around and doing everything, and you're just calmly in the waters catching a few fish. It was really interesting what he said about the effect of the wind farm. That's something I haven't really thought about before, with the big wind farms that are being built offshore and how much the noise of those and just the effect of those might be having on the fish, and that could be why they're staying away that much more over the last couple of years. But I think quite a lot more research has to go into that to see what the actual effect of that is. And if the big trawlers can only fish kind of the other side of those, then we've got this 3-mile patch where it won't be fished. So there could be this lovely oasis that gets created that the smaller boats could benefit from. So it'd be interesting to see how all that pans out. Okay, let's have a song, and I won't do another sea shanty. I'm going to go with Ella Fitzgerald and Someone to Watch Over Me.
There's a somebody I'm longing to see. I hope that he turns out to be someone who'll watch over me.
That was Ella Fitzgerald and Someone to Watch Over Me. As ever, if you do want to find out more about anything that I've talked about on today's show, then do have a look on the Growing Wild show page on RadioReverb.com. You can get in touch via Twitter and Instagram, which is at GrowingWildFM, or you can email, which is GrowingWildReverb@gmail.com, or you can get in touch via the Radio Reverb website. I think the main things that came out of the show were how the loss of these smaller industries do have such a massive impact on community. And so it's really important to try and support these little guys who are still going out and getting their fish. And I actually did get some when I was down there doing these interviews from John Booker, who's been mentioned a few times. And it was so nice, and it only cost £1, and I took it home and cooked it, and it was absolutely delicious. So maybe that's something we could all do, just look out for when these guys put their signs out, say they've got fish, they're coming in at 2 o'clock, and maybe just buy some from them. I'm going to play you out with probably the most legendary song we all know from the sea. And maybe this isn't the best choice, but it's so good. And it's the Jaws theme tune. I think any child of the 80s got royally screwed up by this song. And even now when I'm swimming in the sea in Brighton, I can still just imagine those teeth sometimes. So thank you for listening. Until next time, go well and enjoy the Jaws theme tune.